40 years ago this summer was the Summer of Love in San Francisco, and we're going to be talking about that this hour of our program with Jason Fine, deputy managing editor of Rolling Stone magazine. A member of the new writers of the Purple Sage says, the Summer of Love was crazy and kind of like a renaissance. It was a renaissance for the arts, music, and poetry. It was all flourishing at the time. It was kind of a transition from the folk era of the early 60s to electric bands. It was quite something. Was it a renaissance, we ask? Why did tens of thousands of people travel to San Francisco that summer? Was there a generosity and openness of people during that time that was rather unique, a sense of community? Was there a message of peace, love, and compassion, or was it simply something different? What about the drug use during those years? And what about the music that flourished? The current issue of Rolling Stone magazine is devoted to the Summer of Love, which I understand was the same year the newspaper and later a magazine started. Jason Fine, deputy managing editor of Rolling Stone magazine, is our guest. And I'm particularly interested. Jason can't be here for the whole hour, so I'm counting on some of you who went to San Francisco in 1967 to call in during this hour to talk about what that, why you went and what the experience was. And, of course, we all have thoughts about whether or not it was the beginning of the downfall of the United States, the hippie culture of that time, or whether it was an expression of all things possible, all things good. So we'll welcome phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050 for you to join our conversation. Hi, Jason.
How you doing?
Good. How are you?
Great. Thanks
Good.
For having me.
I was absolutely amazed when the magazine looks at the 40 albums not to be missed that came out during 1967.
Mm-hmm.
What an incredible number of wonderful albums. It was amazing.
It's incredible. And, I mean, if you look at it, too, just look at how many of those albums are by such incredible groups. It was their first album that year. I mean, The Doors released their first album, The Grateful Dead, The Velvet Underground, just on and on. So it was a creative explosion.
Mm-hmm. So it really was a renaissance when it comes to music.
Oh, definitely. You know, and I mean, you know, the single biggest factor for that was drugs. You know, I mean, LSD had become this thing that kids were trying, and it was causing all kinds of creative doors to open.
Mm-hmm. And what was the Summer of Love? You have a piece on where it was born, that it was born outside San Francisco, and that drugs were a big part of this. Tell me about that.
I mean, definitely drugs were a big part of what happened. They weren't the only thing, and I don't know if they were the most important thing, but they were certainly a huge part of a kind of a division, a kind of split, you know, between young people and the people that were older than them. LSD, I mean, it started with marijuana, of course, but LSD and psychedelics had started to kind of bubble up in the Bay Area, particularly in 65. You know, it came out of experiments at colleges, both Harvard and Stanford were doing experiments with LSD, and some of it kind of snuck out into the community. And Ken Kesey was holding these parties that he called acid tests, where everyone took acid and bands played the earliest version of the Grateful Dead, who were called the Warlocks, played at some of the acid tests. And that really set the stage, you know, for what happened both in terms of the gatherings of people in the ballrooms and the dance halls of San Francisco, as well as just, you know, teens trying new things, living new ways, experimenting.
Mm-hmm. Why did tens of thousands, we're talking about lots and lots and lots of people descending on San Francisco 40 years ago, right now actually, why did so many people go there?
Well, I mean, first of all, you know, it was 75,000, they said, by the end of the Summer of Love, by the end of the summer of 67. 75,000 people had come to San Francisco. The city was completely overwhelmed by it. And they came for a lot of reasons, but mainly they came because something was happening there, you know, that wasn't happening elsewhere in the country in the same way. I mean, you know, there was this explosion of music. There was this cheaply available drugs. There were lots and lots of young people. It was the epicenter of a kind of cultural change that, you know, then bubbled outwards and rippled all through the world, you know. I mean, the same things ended up happening, you know, in Prague and in Rio and in Paris and across the world. But They started in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm. And the magazine, it started as a newspaper, but your magazine started then as well.
Yeah, the first issue of Rolling Stone was published in November of 67. It had been in the works for a while before that. Jan Wenner, who founded the magazine, was a student at UC Berkeley and was seeing these changes taking place, watching this music happen, and realizing that really there was no one really covering it in a deep and meaningful way. You know, there was no one really taking it seriously.
Mm.
And that's what Rolling Stone did and still does now.
Mm-hmm. And would you say that there was a big political element to all of this? Or I know there was an anti-establishment. Were there a lot of Vietnam protests? Was there a lot of concern about civil rights? Was it associated with this Summer of Love? Or was it more, this generosity of spirit and this use of drugs and as some would say, too much sex going on?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, there had been a big student protest movement in Berkeley. And in Stanford and at San Francisco State. So in the Bay Area already that had sort of started in 64, civil rights movement was going on. All these movements were happening. What happened in 67 when we think of the Summer of Love wasn't overtly political. There were some political protests, but mainly it was kind of about, you know, personal liberation. It was an experiment in lifestyle. It kind of moved away from the overt politics of it. And a lot of the people who were originally part of those protest movements were really down on what was happening. They thought it was just hedonistic and
mm-hmm.
turning against what were really the important things that we needed to be discussing at the time.
What would be a definition, or were there many, of a hippie?
Well, you know, I mean, hippie came from, the word hippie started in the beat community. The poets who were in North Beach section of San Francisco mainly, but all over the country, earlier. And they referred to, you know, they referred to people as hipsters, cool people as hipsters. The hippies were the sort of, their little hipsters, you know. It was a sort of diminutive hipster, and it was meant with, a little bit of condescension. And that was sort of where it started, but you know, we all have a kind of cliche image of what a hippie was, you know, with long hair and all this. But, you know, it was many things.
Mm-hmm. And what about this? Let's try to talk more about whether or not this was irresponsible behavior, if it was hedonistic, or if indeed there was a sense of community, a sense of generosity, or whether we were witnessing both in the Summer of Love.
I think definitely you were seeing both. You know, I mean, one of the things that I've noticed in a lot of the coverage of the Summer of Love, and there's been a lot, you know, over the past few months, is that there's this kind of attitude about it that it was this sort of cultural blip, you know, where all these freaks took a lot of drugs and had sex and then nothing came of it. And if you look back on it, I mean, really a lot of things did come of it. So certainly there were hedonistic aspects of it, but if you look at a lot of the ways that we look at the world now, I mean, it might sound silly, but things like, you know, vegetarianism, things mm. like a kind of interest in Eastern spiritualism, things like the environmental movement, you know, those all really had their roots in what started in, not in 67, but at that time.
Mm-hmm. And there may have been, you talk about a lot of things did come out of it. There was also a very strong negative response to it, which politically perhaps has lasted to this day.
Oh, my gosh, yes. I mean, you know, Ronald Reagan was inaugurated as governor of California on January 1st, 67. And you know, the Republican backlash began there. I mean, to a degree, you could say that you know, everything that's happening to this day in terms of the way that the Republicans look at culture and you know, the values of the left, all those stereotypes and all those negative critiques began at this time. Bill Clinton said something once, and I'm just paraphrasing him, but he said something like, if you look back at the 60s and you see them negatively, you're probably a Republican.
Hmm.
If you look back at the 60s and you think they were a good time for America, you're probably a Democrat.
Mm-hmm. They sure were a hard time for America, weren't they? When you look at the war, when you look at the assassinations that took place during that decade, it was a hard 10 years.
It sure was. I mean, and look at the parallels with where we are now. You know, they're rich.
What are they?
Well, I mean, you know, again, we're in a war that no one wants. You know, we're stuck there. Again, we're in a time of very divisive politics. You know, again, we're wrestling with these kinds of big issues about the national identity that we were back then.
Mm-hmm. And do you see a similar kind of flourishing of music, of poetry, that we saw back in 67 now as a response to all that's going on in the world or not?
Certainly in music. I mean, there's a lot going on in music right now. We did a piece about 6 months ago where we just kind of ran down all the protest songs that were out right now.
Mm-hmm.
And there were so many of them. You know, I mean, when we look back in hindsight, they might not be as kind of sort of defining songs as they were in 67, because everything is so much more fragmented now and there's so much more pop culture now than there was, you know, at the time. So many people are interested in so many different things and have access to so much stuff. But just in terms of music, I mean, it's a really rich time for music, and so many artists are writing so much interesting stuff that's reflecting on the issues that we're facing today. So yeah, I think it is really interesting in that way.
Mm-hmm. We're going to welcome phone calls. Jason Fine is our guest, deputy managing editor of Rolling Stone magazine, and they have a current issue, which is devoted to the Summer of Love, the same year the newspaper, which was later a magazine, was started. We're looking at the origins of this, and we're trying to figure out if what happened had, as everything does, elements of good and maybe not so good. Many of you, I'm sure, listening lived through that summer. Perhaps some of you went to San Francisco, as 75,000 people did, some of you in Wisconsin, I'm sure, made the trip, and I'd be particularly interested in hearing from you. We're looking at the music that came from just that one year is just, you know, amazing. Mississippi John Hurt, Aretha Franklin, Grateful Dead album, Velvet Underground, Otis Redding, the Arlo Guthrie, Alice's Restaurant came from 1967, Procol Harum, Van Morrison, Cream, the Beach Boys, The Beatles, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. We did a show on that recently. The Velvet Underground. The list just goes on. Amazing number of albums released during that time period. Did it have a lasting impact, I guess, is what I'm asking. That whole era, did it have a lasting impact? Why is it that we're commemorating this in 2007? It's hard to believe this was 40 years ago as well. I welcome your phone calls. Join us, won't you? Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. 414-227-2050. All our lines are open for Jason, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jason Fine is our guest. We're talking about the Summer of Love 40 years ago this summer in 1967. He's deputy managing editor of Rolling Stone magazine, the current issue of the magazine devoted to the Summer of Love. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. A couple lines are open for you if you'd like to join the conversation. And we go to Chet from Maquoneago. Hi, Chet.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm so glad to be talking to you guys today, and congratulations on celebrating the 40th.
Thank you.
I have a simple question, and it's more of a, it's almost a statement as well. I teach in grade school, and I have teenage children, and I see in history how the youth, the thinking of the youth in great numbers, has actually transformed the thinking of the time. I think there's a cultural change that happens with when the youth kind of gather, and I think it's a powerful statement, and that can't be denied a lot of times. And I try to tell the children that I teach, you know, it's your time, it's your time. And I'll take your answer.
What do you hope your children will do with their time?
You know, I often help them to turn inward and ask themselves who they are and what they're thinking at the time, and what their true soul is telling them. And I think when they really tune in, when they're allowed to tune in at an earlier age to express themselves truly, then they find that answer. And I think I really like to see them latch on to the ability to express themselves truthfully, you know, and experience what's happening in the culture of the time and the generations of people around them.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Chet. Jason?
Yeah. Well, do you sense in the kids some kind of collective ideas about the world and about the world that we live in?
I do. I sense that they're wanting to take more of themselves, take more of responsibility for what is theirs and not what is our generations or the generations before. I mean, my kids love a lot of the music that I listen to, and I play music with them. They're both musicians, but they still have their own thing, and they really want to make sure that they got their own music, they got their own language. I swear, when we have them over and I hang with the kids, they can only take so much of me. You know, they speak a different language. You know,
one thing that we find always with our readers and with this issue, but with other issues too, is that so many young people, as they grow up, you know, when they get to be teenagers, say, are interested in this music that came out of the 60s. The Doors seem really relevant to them, and the Stones seem really relevant to them, and they all listen to the Beatles, you know. And it's kind of incredible because, I mean, I think about it just personally. You know, I grew up in the 80s. In the 80s, I wasn't listening to music that came from the 40s. You know, that would have seemed like ancient stuff from some other world. But stuff from the 60s now seems vital and relevant. And I think a lot of people grow up and kind of go through that music and find a lot in it.
Mm-hmm. I think that a lot of people who lived through that era have struggled and who now have kids who are in their 20s or who are teenagers really struggle with the drug issue of that summer and the drug issue of that time. Don't know what to say to their kids about usage of drugs, whether or not they use them. They have a hard time figuring out what all that meant and whether or not it was good.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it was a time of great experimentation in all kinds of ways then, you know, and the drugs that people were using, you know, I mean, certainly hard drugs crept in later, you know, heroin and cocaine and everything. But the drugs that people were using to experiment with, chiefly LSD, were drugs that people weren't just taking just to have a party, just to have a good time, you know, they were drugs that people were using to see the world in a different way, to understand themselves a little bit more deeply, you know. And I know that sounds a little naive now, but it really was the case. You know, not everyone, but a lot of people. And a lot of people had creative breakthroughs, personal breakthroughs that came out of that, you know. So, I mean, drugs can be a lot of different things, I think.
Thanks, Chet, so much for the call. Let's go to Scott from the Dells. Hi, Scott.
Hi there. Thank you for the program, Kathleen. Excellent again. I have a little bit of a different perspective, I guess. I was born and raised in the San Francisco Bay Area, and I turned 20 during that summer. And my argument is that the big loser in all this really was the city of San Francisco. And what I mean by that is, I don't think it was the hippies per se, but it was the whole media madness that enveloped that community and made it such a magnet for what we wound up referring to as the hip-wazee. And it really, you know, the hippies themselves came out, and they were really a bunch of decent folks. But, you know, everybody that came en masse brought out, I think, the worst, and it turned what had been a really wonderful, tolerant city that loved its eccentrics into what it is now. And, you know, my story that epitomizes what it is now is being on the Bayshore Freeway one day and watching a guy swerving in and out of traffic and flipping somebody off, and then noticing his Grateful Dead bumper sticker.
Oh, no.
I said, there you go, partner. Welcome to the Bay Area.
So this is a big birthday year for you, Scott, huh?
Well, as a matter of fact, yeah, you noticed that. You count that up, huh? Yeah, and in fact, every time I go back out there, which isn't very frequently anymore, but every time I do, I always, you know, I get out there, and I'm always struck by, you know, how beautiful it is, and how, you know, comfortable it is in terms of the weather and everything. And by the time I've been there for, you know, whatever it is, a week or two, I'm so ready to get back to Wisconsin and the folks in the Midwest.
Why? Why is it?
I'm just you know, the madness, the crowding, the rudeness, the all the things that San Francisco's become. I mean, you will not believe this, but it used to be like this really, as I say, tolerant, sleepy kind of a city for a big city that had all this really charming aspect to it and all these stories of the great old eccentrics that, you know, Emperor Norton, who, you know, tried to, you know, was the emperor of San Francisco. This was, you know, way before my time. But, you know, it kind of had that feel to it. And then it's amazing how quickly that drained away once it got known as this, as they say, the place for all the hip folks to be.
Right, right.
I mean, that's my perspective. I'm probably, I'm sure there's a million people that would argue against it. Mm-hmm. But
I lived there for 12 years, and I never found it to be the most friendly place in the world.
Really, Jason?
No.
Huh.
Yeah, I mean, I share much the same experience with the caller.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Scott, for your call.
Thanks for the program.
Yeah.
Bye now.
Thanks. Our number is 800-486-8655. What time do you have to leave, Jason?
Pretty soon.
Pretty soon?
About 5 minutes.
5 minutes, so we can take a couple more calls?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's go to Larry from Madison next. Hi, Larry. Larry? Are you there, Larry? Nah, Larry's not there. Elaine, is it, from Wausau?
Yes. I lived out in San Francisco for all of the time I was in high school. I moved there in 63, and it was a great place to live. I had, my younger sister and her friends, and we all hung around. We lived about 5 blocks from Haight-Ashbury and from Golden Gate Park. We used to go over there every day and play. They had a carousel in the middle of the park. That was like, I still love carousels from riding on that one all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, pretty different. It's pretty different from what most of the callers have called in and said. You know, people, because I was out of it before 67, pretty much, that, I just saw the beginning part, and it was really, really nice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everybody was nice. The city, you had to watch where you went. Because, you know, like every city, it had its really bad neighborhoods.
Right.
But most of them, most places you could walk, and it was like here in Wausau. You know, you didn't have to worry about where you went.
Right.
You know, we used to, when we were just kids, my younger brothers were 5, 7, and 8, and like on Saturdays they used to go wherever they wanted, and nobody worried. You know,
nobody worried. That sounds like part of the summer of 67 or one of the themes of it. Thank you so much for the call. Jason, let's just talk briefly about some of the music, because we haven't done enough of that. Bob Dylan, what did Bob Dylan do in 67?
Bob Dylan in 67 was living in Woodstock. He had had a motorcycle accident in the summer of 66, and he had kind of retreated up to Woodstock to recover. And the guys who were playing in his band then, who were then called the Hawks and later became the band, moved up to Woodstock too, and they started kind of woodshedding up there in the basement of a house that came to be known as Big Pink. And they started recording together. They were just doing old folk songs and things like that, and then they started to write songs. And Dylan wrote an incredible number of songs in 67. He wrote like 30 songs just that summer. And then by the end of the year, he went off and recorded John Wesley Harding, which, you know, was sort of antithetical to everything else that was happening in terms of, you know, the psychedelic drug music that was going on, the electric guitars and all the heavy production of things like Sgt. Pepper's. This was a very stripped down, almost country sounding record that he recorded in Nashville. So he was kind of going the other way, you know. I interviewed Robbie Robertson from the band who played with Dylan all through that year up in Woodstock, and he said, you know, we were pretty cut off up there, and we didn't really realize we were rebelling against the rebellion, which they really were. And, you know, then the band put out their first record in early 68, music from Big Pink. So it was a really vital little, you know, hideaway up there.
Yeah. What a life this musician has had, hasn't he?
Dylan?
Oh, yeah. Contribution to music is unbelievable. What about the Grateful Dead and their association with the Summer of Love particularly?
Well, I mean, the Dead were living on Haight Street, you know, and the Dead had been the house band at the acid test that we talked about, the Ken Kesey acid test. You know, they were always a live thing. They released their first record in 67, but that wasn't really the event. The event was the shows that they were putting on. You know, one day in 67, they decided to put on a spontaneous show on Haight Street, and something like 10,000 people showed up. I mean, it was just amazing. And they were one of the most popular bands in the city at the time. They played with the light shows, and it was just kind of these incredible gatherings of people dancing, and, and it was pretty remarkable.
Arlo Guthrie was 20 years old in that year and released Alice's Restaurant.
Yeah, that's right.
Which is still being played.
It still is being played. I was at the place that was Alice's Restaurant recently.
Oh, really?
No, no longer Alice's Restaurant, but it's something else. Yeah, up in Massachusetts.
Aretha Franklin, she was big in 67.
Yeah, you know, Aretha had been around, but she hadn't really found her sound yet. And she signed to Atlantic, and they took her down to Muscle Shoals to record, and recorded one song down there and then finished the record back in New York. And, wow, you know, I mean, Aretha just exploded that year.
Otis Redding.
Otis Redding was also touring and playing, and but he hadn't really crossed over to a white audience. You know, he was pretty much known in the black community and as a great soul singer. But when he played at Monterey, he had a kind of career-making performance that was just explosive, and he found his rock audience then. Unfortunately, he died before the year was out. He died just a few days after he recorded one of his greatest songs, Sitting on the Dock of the Bay, which was actually inspired by sitting on the dock of a houseboat that he stayed on when he played at the Monterey Festival.
Oh, my. Jason, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Jason Fine, Deputy Managing Editor of Rolling Stone Magazine, the current issue devoted to the Summer of Love, and Rolling Stone Magazine, interestingly, was started in the year 1967. We're talking about the music. We're talking about the 75,000-plus people who came to San Francisco at that time, what it all meant, why we're commemorating it now, too. We'll talk more about that as we continue. And I'm particularly interested in hearing from you now. Jason had to leave us. We're going to play some of the music from the Summer of Love, 1967, and also talk to you about what it meant. Some of you may think that it was, you know, the beginning of the decline of America as we know it. Those were the years that were terrible for the country, and it's been downhill, and there's been, as you know, a very strong response, negative response to the Summer of Love and to the 1960s. Others will say that it was a time of trying to experiment with different ways of living, of flourishing of poetry, of music, and not terribly associated with a big political movement in this country, although certainly that was a major backdrop here. The war in Vietnam escalating, there were race riots, there was concern about civil rights in this country, although the focus of the Summer Love, I think, was somewhat different. And some of you, I'm sure, went there. If you were there, tell your story, okay? 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, the Milwaukee line is 414-227-2050.
Casey Jones, you better watch your speed. Trouble ahead, trouble behind. And know that notion just crossed my mind. This old engine makes it on time. Leave Central Station about a quarter to nine. Hit Trevor Junction at 17-2 at a quarter to 10. You know it's driving again. Driving that train, I'm cocaine. Casey Jones, you better watch your speed. Trouble ahead, trouble behind.
The Grateful Dead, Casey Jones, that song. And we'll continue your phone calls as we talk about the Summer of Love here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go back to your phone calls now and to Dave from Green Bay. Hi, Dave.
Hi. I went out to San Francisco with a couple of my buddies from the University of Illinois in Chicago.
Oh.
And one was an Army veteran. His name was Emerson. Another guy's name was Jack. And he was the vice president of the SDS chapter.
Oh, my gosh.
So it was, you know, kind of a conglomeration, and I was just a suburbanite kid and going down to the downtown campus, and so we kind of all pooled our money. We thought it'd be great if we could get out there, and we went out camping, and I got a Chevy Corvair, and so the three of us were there. We had our, you know, we had a little portable stereo system so we could listen to our tapes and our music, and we went out there, and we just had a terrific time, and you can't mention San Francisco without and the music without talking about the Fillmore East Auditorium.
Right,
that's where
yes.
A lot of the great shows were going on. And, you know, San Francisco, you know, did have this kind of laid-back and, you know, a multicultural kind of flavor to it, you know, of course, with Chinatown and as a big tourist mechanism, beautiful place to be. And it certainly wasn't as pricey a place as San Francisco is today. I mean, it was a place where you could go as a young person and still manage to eke out and survive for a while.
Mm-hmm. And why did you want to go? What do you remember what motivated you to make the trip?
Well, yeah, I mean, it just seemed to be a place where a lot of things that resonated were going on.
Mm.
The music, you know, there was the politics. You know, we were kind of reacting. In a way, I think that the 1967... in a way, it was kind of the end of the Eisenhower era. You know, it was kind of a very straight, more of a straight-laced kind of culture. And this is a way of youth rebellion, and it was in the context of the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement, and that was starting to really accelerate. And, you know, people like not only Bob Dylan and Arlo Guthrie, but Phil Oakes and, you know, Mamas and Papas. So it was just great to be out there in San Francisco, although... one of the things that you think of California and how warm it is, but San Francisco can also be pretty chilly. And,
right, foggy, chilly, yes.
Yeah, we went out to see an outdoor movie, and the fog came in, and we couldn't see anything.
No.
We were sitting there in the middle of the fog trying to see this movie, and I guess you can't have that, you know, you can have that opportunity in San Francisco quite frequently. So
you just made up the movie in your mind. That's part of San Francisco as well.
You could listen to the sound, and, you know,
right.
That was about it.
Right.
But it definitely, you know, was a very permissive environment. And so, you know, people were taking mescaline and peyote as well as LSD and marijuana. And obviously, you know, people like Timothy Leary were around talking about consciousness raising. But, you know, people were, well, yeah, this is altering my central nervous system and altering my perceptions. And that certainly made listening to music or eating, you know, eating chocolate brownies and all the stuff that we did, you know. And of course, you know, the risks of bad drugs and everything weren't anywhere near, you know, we weren't as conscious then of that as you know, as subsequently become. And but, you know, there was a much more permissive climate where people were just kind of doing that without a sense of, well, you know, terrible risk or danger. And I guess that was just part of the fun of it, just to walk around and meet everybody else. And You know, I was a suburbanite from the Chicago area. So
where are you from?
A way for me to meet from Oak Park.
Oh, yeah.
And I became a living fossil last year when I turned 60, so this resonates with me.
I'm sure it did.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you so much for calling. Yeah, this is great. I knew there'd be people who went out there. I just didn't know how many of you there'd be, and there are quite a few. Kathleen from La Crosse. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm from La Crosse, and I moved out there to work at Stanford at the clinic during that summer. And I just think it's really strange that it wasn't just the hippies that were going through a lot of that. A lot of the doctors would have parties, and these parties would, you know, we were smoking marijuana, people were taking their clothes off. So it wasn't just, you know, who you thought it was at that time. But the art was just wonderful. The paintings you could get and the sculptures, and it was just a beautiful culture. I loved it. I miss it.
You do?
I'm back in La Crosse now, and I'm thinking of moving back out there.
Are you?
To work, yeah.
Do you think that part of that culture remains in San Francisco now?
I have friends out there, and they say it's a little different, but it's still, you know, they wouldn't move for anything.
Hmm. And what about the summer of love? Are there parts of what happened that summer, for good or for ill, that stay with us 40 years later?
I think of it as a good time because everybody was trying to change everything for the better. And that's what I remember is when you'd go to the parks and everybody would be hanging out and they were just preaching, you know, love and peace and... It was just that feeling throughout the whole city. That's what I remember about it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Kathleen.
You bet.
A couple lines are open. We're talking about the summer of love. And I'm particularly interested in hearing from those of you who were in San Francisco during the summer of love. Or if you want to, if you're younger or older, too, call to talk about why we're commemorating it now and what remains from that time. Was it a renaissance or not? 800-486-8655. Jim is next from Galena. Hi, Jim.
Hello, how are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm going out to sing at the Monterey Pop Festival, and I will also be in Summer of Love there, which is next weekend. And then I'll be singing at the Summer of Love in Golden Gate Park. They expect 500,000 people.
Oh, my gosh.
So I don't think it'll be the same. And when I was thinking about the other night, I was having so much fun at my little theater here. I'm singing for 56 people, you know, and doing my Mark Twain piece. And we're just I couldn't be having a better time. And when I left, I thought, well, I won't have any more fun, but I'm sure going to hear some great music while I'm there. And one of the things I thought about was the lady who was on just before me. It wasn't a matter of people who were there. That summer was happening from one end of the country to the other. And when I wrote my hit song, I was at a love-in in New York City in Central Park. And we were throwing flowers at the policeman who just thought we were the greatest kids in the world. and we were loaded to the gills. And so I wrote my hit song. We went to the hotel, learned it, and went over to the record company. And the guy said, I only take tapes because you're a cute little couple here. And I don't want to be influenced by your cuteness. I want to hear the music. And I said, well, turn around and look out the window. He turned and looked out the window, and we had a hit song. But the interesting the way that hit is a guy from Chico, California, played Reach Out in the Darkness, and Chico being a big college town, sold twice as much as it had sold anywhere else, you know, a number one song normally sold. He went to he was transferred to San Francisco. And remember the selective service set in where they arrested 3,000 people? But he grabbed my song and went out there and started playing it for him and made sure everyone up on the West Coast got it. It hit all over the West and hit the Midwest and Southwest, but New York City wouldn't go on it, so it went down to number 13, and then someone shot Martin Luther King and New York went on it. So the one thing I'm really proud of my little hit record is the fact that... it was hooked to social movement.
You want to sing a little bit of it?
Because I think it's so groovy now that people are finally getting together. Think it's wonderful how
people are finally getting together, remember?
I sure
Reach
do,
out
yeah.
in the darkness. It's been played 1,600,000 times. And the excitement of why I'm going to Monterey is that I've combined it with the Youngblood song, Come On People Now, Smile On Your Brother.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Well, I've combined it. Those two songs fit together like just beautifully.
Hmm.
And so Clive Davis is going to be at Monterey, and I want to see if I can get him, the guy who's brought me out there, to let us re-record it, David Crosby and I, and get Carlos Santana to be the band underneath it.
Great. You're going to have quite a summer there, Jim. Thank you so much for calling in. Our number is 800-486-8655, 227-2050 in Milwaukee, and we are talking about 40 years later, the summer of love of 67. On
when
the
truth is found to be lies, and all the joy within you dies, don't you want somebody to love? Don't you need somebody to love? Wouldn't you love somebody to love? You better find somebody to love. Love.
800-486-8655 is the number, and we go next to Doris. Hi, Doris.
Hi. Yes, I'm calling from outside of Duluth.
Mm-hmm.
Here. I wasn't one of those people.
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, please call back. I made a mistake and pressed the wrong button. Please call back. We got a line open just for you. Jeff from Brookfield. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. How are you?
All right. How are you?
Good. Great show. Hey, I wanted to just add one band that I felt was a little overlooked from your list earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Frank Zappa, the Muppet Convention.
Yeah. Right, right.
He was busy, really, from 67, 68, leading up to Summer of Love, pretty much lampooning the hippie culture and the whole Summer of Love thing with his albums, Absolutely Free and We're Only in It for the Money, which were released in 67 and 68. And then come 69, when everybody else is kind of reaching that zenith during the Summer of Love, he's releasing Hot Rats, which is an amazing, primarily instrumental record, one of his best. And I just wanted to make sure that, since you had mentioned with your earlier guest from Rolling Stone about how the band was sort of unaware that they were rebelling against that culture,
mm-hmm.
That Zappa was doing it with great consciousness and great insight and great wit during that whole period.
We also didn't mention Jimi Hendrix, who was so big during that year as well.
Absolutely. And another, just a sidebar note, the chance for those people who maybe aren't as familiar with Zappa as they might be, his son, Dweezil, is playing in the band this weekend in Milwaukee.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's called Zappa Plays Zappa.
Oh.
And they're doing all of Frank's old music, a huge set list, and have video of him playing guitar that are interspersed in the show, and that's on Saturday night. So for people who might want to catch that part of the culture, they'll be doing a great show on Saturday.
Great. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Uh-huh. Bye. Let's connect to Bobby from Stevens Point. Hi, Bobby.
Hi. Good morning.
Hi.
Yeah, I was in late high school that summer, and not sure the exact timeline, but within a short time got to hear Jefferson Airplane. They were an airplane, and also got to hear a little bit of Zappa, of course, for us living in Jersey at the time, Greenwich Village was our San Francisco, so we'd get on the commuter train and go up there. But the thing I wanted to say was I still find it relevant today, and anybody who thinks it's just, archaeology to delve into that is wrong. Because there's still a very lively psychedelic movement going on now. Albert Hoffman, the man who discovered LSD, he just turned 101 years old, and he still talks to packed houses everywhere. So that's still going on. There's a lively underground psychedelic movement. We still have a peace movement. We still have a civil rights movement that's got a lot to accomplish. And 2 weeks ago, we went to Live Earth Wisconsin Festival, and it was the craziest thing to see all these gray-haired hippies along with, young kids from the Twin Cities who came out to hear the music. So I think this summer is very relevant, and I think it'll keep attracting. It'll attract a multi-generational crowd, whatever happens this summer.
Thanks, Bobby. Thanks so much for your call. Doris is back. I'm glad. I'm sorry, Doris. I pressed the wrong button. Hi.
Oh, okay. You lost me.
I lost you. It was my fault. Go ahead.
Well, I don't know how far I went, but I was trying to say that I think there were, you know, a big ripple effect from San Francisco to other cities. I think the things that happened there, people brought back. And the main point I want to make is a couple of years after that in Chicago, all sorts of fascinating things were happening. And the group that I was a part of started this big community movement of offering free therapy-type groups. It was, you know, they were staffed with one professional person, one other person interested in the field, and we had this, you know, big therapy collective going and a big movement going on. And at one time, there were 21 groups running in our little community with people from the community, and it was like a, you know, it was like the effect of what started out there moved over into Chicago and really blossomed in so many ways. And this was, so you're talking about the summer of 68, our group was up and running in 71. So a lot of things, I think, happened after San Francisco.
I think you're right. Thank you so much for your call.
Okay, thanks.
Henry is next from Green Lake. Hi, Henry.
Hi. I love this topic because I hark back to when we went out there, there were five of us from Milwaukee. We were all students, and we went out to San Francisco that summer and found a landlord that would rent us a two-bedroom apartment. We didn't have any furniture. We slept on the floor. One fellow worked in a candy factory, the Big Hunk Chew factory. Two of them caddied. We were all law students. With two of them caddied. I worked for an airline. And we just had a ball. We would go down to Golden Gate Park, and Grateful Dead and Jefferson Airplane would give free concerts. We, on Sundays, would go up the coast across the Golden Gate Bridge, Stinson Beach, and swim. It was just incredibly cold water. I can remember the Mamas and Papas and all the other music blaring in our apartment, and it was a fantastic summer. And we would wander down at Haight-Ashbury, and you know, we weren't into drugs and other things like that, but that whole feeling of San Francisco and that period were still rings with me.
So it was good.
It was fantastic, and it just, you know, Haight-Ashbury, if people focus in on that, you know, there were a lot of people that were free-spirited that weren't necessarily totally into that summer of love, drug haze. There was a lot of people into the music and just trying to be anti-war, trying to figure out what was happening in Vietnam and with our futures. And in some ways, that a previous caller talked about the end of the Eisenhower era, because we were all of that period of the happy Ozzie and Harriet 50s. And then all of a sudden, the 60s hit, and there were problems. And I know for myself, I was 1A for a long time, just lucky that I never got drafted. But I took two physicals in the infamous Oakland Induction Center. I can remember walking around in my underwear there, wondering if I was going to get drafted. It was strange times that way. But it was San Francisco was a special place, and it still is. But it was a great time.
40 years ago.
I hate to think of it. When I look in the mirror, I don't feel that old, but I guess I am.
But maybe because of that, you're not that old now.
Yeah,
right?
I think so. I still love the music, and interestingly enough, that era of music has held. It's still very popular and played all the time. And the strangest thing is, I wasn't too fond of the Grateful Dead. I saw a few of their concerts by accident, but I had two sons, and they, as they grew up in central Wisconsin, were crazy about the Grateful Dead. One drove all the way out to Cleveland to see them, and the other one saw them at, I think, Jerry Garcia's last concert down in Chicago at Soldier Field.
Why? Why do you think they were so taken by
them? I don't know. They heard me talk a little bit about it, I think. And, you know, it's one of those things where, well, Dad saw them, and it was, yeah, you were of that era. You know, they have this fantasy that I was this crazy hippie smoking dope all the time. And, you know, I don't dispel it, but it's not the truth. But the fact of the matter is, you could be free-spirited and fun-loving without being, you know, so wound up because
right.
the Haight-Ashbury, honestly, I lived there for 2 years after my friends went back to Milwaukee, and I lived near University of San Francisco, right across on Stanion Street, right across from Haight-Ashbury. You know, just Stanion goes across the Golden Gate Park
sure,
there.
Sure, sure.
And it was a different period, and the Haight really there was a flash, and
mm-hmm.
it was a thing, but it became a sad place.
Yeah. Thanks so much for your call. Thanks everybody for all of your calls, for remembering the Summer of Love. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and to Sharome Owens for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. Thanks for all of your calls. Hard to believe that was 40 years ago, isn't it? Have a good weekend. I'm Kathleen Dunn, All Things Political, 9 o'clock on Monday.
If you think that I don't know about the little chick you